Side 9. Chapter 11. The World Message Consortium. The world is nearly all parceled out, and what there is left of it is being divided up, conquered, and colonized. To think of these stars that you see overhead at night, these vast worlds which we can never reach, I would annex the planets if I could. I often think of that. It makes me sad to see them so clear, and yet so far. Cecil Rhodes, Last Will and Testament, 1902. From their table by the window, she could see the downpour spattering the street outside. A soaked pedestrian, his collar up, gamely hurried by. The proprietor had cranked the striped awning over the tubs of oysters, segregated according to size and quality, and providing a kind of street advertisement for the specialty of the house. She felt warm and snug inside the restaurant, the famous theatrical gathering place, Chez Dieu. Since fair weather had been predicted, she was without raincoat or umbrella. Likewise unencumbered, Vege introduced a new subject.
"My friend Mira," he announced, "is an ecdysiast. That is the right word, yes? When she works in your country, she performs for groups of professionals at meetings and conventions. Mira says that when she takes off her clothes for working-class men at trade union conventions, that sort of thing, they become wild, shout out improper suggestions, and try to join her on the stage. But when she gives exactly the same performance for doctors or lawyers, they sit there motionless. Actually, she says, some of them lick their lips. My question is, are the lawyers healthier than the steelworkers?" That Vege had diverse female acquaintances had always been apparent. His approaches to women were so direct and extravagant, herself, for some reason that both pleased and annoyed her, excluded, that they could always say no without embarrassment. Many said yes. But the news about Mira was a little unexpected. They had spent the morning in a last-minute comparison of notes and interpretations of the new data. The continuing message transmission had reached an important new stage. Diagrams were being transmitted from Vega, the way newspaper wire photos are transmitted. Each picture was an array raster. The number of tiny black-and-white dots that made up the picture was the product of two prime numbers. Again, prime numbers were part of the transmission. There was a large set of such diagrams, one following the other, and not at all interleaved with the text. It was like a section of glossy illustrations inserted in the back of a book. Following transmission of the long sequence of diagrams, the unintelligible text continued. From at least some of the diagrams, it seemed obvious that Vege and Arkhangelsky had been right, that the message was in part at least the instructions, the blueprints for building a machine. Its purpose was unknown. At the plenary session of the World Message Consortium, to be held tomorrow at the Elysee Palace, she and Vege would present for the first time some of the details to representatives of the other consortium nations. But word had quietly been passed about the machine hypothesis. Over lunch, she had summarized her encounter with Rankin and Joss. Vege had been attentive, but asked no questions. It was as if she had been confessing some unseemly personal predilection, and perhaps that had triggered his train of association. "You have a friend named Mira who's a striptease artist? With international venue?"
Since Wolfgang Pauli discovered the exclusion principle while watching the Folies Bergère, I have felt it my professional duty as a physicist to visit Paris as much as possible. I think of it as my homage to Pauli. But somehow I can never persuade the officials in my country to approve trips solely for this purpose. Usually I must do some pedestrian physics as well. But in such establishments, that's where I met Mira. I am a student of nature, waiting for insight to strike."
Abruptly, his tone of voice shifted from expansive to matter-of-fact.
Mira says American professional men are sexually repressed and have gnawing doubts and guilt.
Really? And what does Mira say about Russian professional men?
Ah, in that category she knows only me, so of course she has a good opinion. I think I'd rather be with Mira tomorrow.
But all your friends will be at the consortium meeting, she said lightly.
Yes, I'm glad you'll be there, he replied morosely.
What's worrying you, Vege? He took a long time before answering, and began with a slight but uncharacteristic hesitation.
Perhaps not worries, maybe only concerns. What if the message really is the design drawings of a machine? Do we build a machine? Who builds it? Everybody together? The consortium? The United Nations? A few nations in competition? What if it's enormously expensive to build? Who pays? Why should they want to? What if it doesn't work? Could building the machine injure some nations economically? Could it injure them in some other way?
Without interrupting this torrent of questions, Lunacharsky emptied the last of the wine into their glasses. Even if the message cycles back, and even if we completely decrypt it, how good could the translation be?
You know the opinion of Cervantes? He said that reading a translation is like examining the back of a piece of tapestry. Maybe it's not possible to translate the message perfectly. Then we wouldn't build a machine perfectly. Also, are we really confident we have all the data? Maybe there's essential information at some other frequency that we haven't discovered yet.
You know, Ellie, I thought people would be very cautious about building this machine. But there may be some coming tomorrow who will urge immediate construction. I mean immediately after we receive the primer and decrypt the message, assuming that we do. What is the American delegation going to propose?
I don't know, she said slowly. But she remembered that soon after the diagrammatic material had been received, Drahir began asking whether it was likely that the machine was within reach of the Earth's economy and technology. She could offer him little reassurance on either score. She recalled again how preoccupied Ken had seemed in the last few weeks, sometimes even jittery. His responsibilities in this matter were, of course...
Are Dr. Drahir and Mr. Kitts staying at the same hotel as you?
No, they're staying at the embassy. It was always the case. Because of the nature of the Soviet economy and the perceived necessity of buying military technology instead of consumer goods with their limited hard currency, Russians had little walking around money when visiting the West. They were obliged to stay in second or third-rate hotels, even rooming houses, while their Western colleagues lived in comparative luxury. It was a continuing source of embarrassment for scientists of both countries. Picking up the bill for this relatively simple meal would be effortless for Ellie, but a burden for Vege, despite his comparatively exalted status in the Soviet scientific hierarchy. Now, what was Vege? Vege, be straight with me. What are you saying? You think Ken and Mike Kitts are jumping the gun?
Straight.
An interesting word. Not right, not left, but progressively forward.
I'm concerned that in the next few days we will see premature discussion about building something that we have no right to build. The politicians think we know everything.
In fact, we know almost nothing. Such a situation could be dangerous.
It finally dawned on her that Vege was taking a personal responsibility for figuring out the nature of the message. If it led to some catastrophe, he was worried it might be his fault. He had less personal motives as well, of course. You want me to talk to Ken?
If you think it's appropriate, you have frequent opportunities to talk to him?
He said this casually. Vege, you're not jealous, are you? I think you picked up on my feelings for Ken before I did, when you were back at Argus. Ken and I have been more or less together for the last 2 months. Do you have some reservations?
Oh, no, Ellie, I am not your father or jealous lover. I wish only great happiness for you. It's just that I see so many unpleasant possibilities.
But he did not further elaborate. They returned to their preliminary interpretations of some of the diagrams, with which the table was eventually covered. For counterpoint, they also discussed a little politics, the debate in America over the mandala principles for resolving the crisis in South Africa, and the growing war of words between the Soviet Union and the German Democratic Republic. As always, Arroway and Lunacharsky enjoyed denouncing their own country's foreign policies to one another. This was far more interesting than denouncing the foreign policies of each other's nation, which would have been equally easy to do. Over their ritual dispute about whether the check should be shared, she noticed that the downpour had diminished to a discreet drizzle. By now the news of the message from Vega had reached every nook and cranny of the planet Earth. People who knew nothing of radio telescopes and had never heard of a prime number had been told a peculiar story about a voice from the stars, about strange beings, not exactly men, but not exactly gods either, who had been discovered living in the night sky. They did not come from Earth. Their home star could easily be seen, even with a full moon. Amidst the continuing frenzy of sectarian commentary, there was also, all over the world, it was now apparent, a sense of wonder, even of awe, something transforming, something almost miraculous was happening. The air was full of possibility, a sense of new beginning. "Mankind has been promoted to high school," an American newspaper editorialist had written. There were other intelligent beings in the universe. We could communicate with them. They were probably older than we, possibly wiser. They were sending us libraries of complex information. There was a widespread anticipation of imminent secular revelation. So the specialists in every subject began to worry. Mathematicians worried about what elementary discoveries they might have missed. Religious leaders worried that vegan values, however alien, would find ready adherence, especially among the uninstructed young. Astronomers worried that there might be fundamentals about the nearby stars that they had gotten wrong. Politicians and government leaders worried that some other systems of government, some quite different from those currently fashionable, might be admired by a superior civilization. Whatever vegans knew had not been influenced by peculiarly human institutions, history, or biology. What if much that we think true is a misunderstanding, a special case or a logical blunder? Experts uneasily began to reassess the foundations of their subjects. Beyond this narrow vocational disquiet was a great and soaring perception of a new adventure for the human species, of turning a corner, of bursting into a new age, a symbolism powerfully amplified by the approach of the third millennium. There were still political conflicts, some of them, like the continuing South African crisis, serious. But there was also a notable decline in many quarters of the world of jingoist rhetoric and puerile self-congratulatory nationalism. There was a sense of the human species, billions of tiny beings spread over the world, collectively presented with an unprecedented opportunity, or even a grave common danger. To many it seemed absurd for the contending nation-states to continue their deadly quarrels when faced with a non-human civilization of vastly greater capabilities. There was a whiff of hope in the air. Some people were unaccustomed to it, and mistook it for something else, confusion, perhaps, or cowardice. For decades after 1945, the world stockpile of strategic nuclear weapons had steadily grown. Leaders changed, weapons systems changed, strategy changed. But the number of strategic weapons only increased. The time came when there were more than 25,000 of them on the planet, 10 for every city. The technology was pushing towards short flight time, incentives for hard target first strike, and at least de facto launch on warning. Only so monumental a danger could undo so monumental a foolishness. Endorsed by so many leaders and so many nations for so long a time. But finally the world came to its senses, at least to this extent, and an accord was signed by the United States, the Soviet Union, Britain, France, and China. It was not intended to rid the world of nuclear weapons. Few expected it to carry some utopia in its wake. But the Americans and the Russians undertook to diminish their strategic arsenals down to 1,000 nuclear weapons each. The details were carefully designed so that neither superpower was at any significant disadvantage at any stage of the dismantling process. Britain, France, and China agreed to begin reducing their arsenals once the superpowers had gone below the 3,200 mark. The Hiroshima Accords were signed, to worldwide rejoicing, next to the famous commemorative plaque for the victims in the first city ever obliterated by a nuclear weapon. Rest in peace, for it shall never happen again. Every day the fission triggers from an equal number of U.S. and Soviet warheads were delivered to a special facility run by American and Russian technicians. The plutonium was extracted, logged, sealed, and transported by bilateral teams to nuclear power plants, where it was consumed and converted into electricity. This scheme, known as the Gaylor Plan after an American admiral, was widely hailed as the ultimate in beating swords into plowshares. Since each nation still retained a devastating retaliatory capability, even the military establishments eventually welcomed it. Generals no more wish for their children to die than anyone else, and nuclear war is the negation of the conventional military virtues. It is hard to find much valor in pressing a button. The first divestment ceremony, televised live and rebroadcast many times, featured white-clad American and Soviet technicians wheeling in two of the dull gray metallic objects, each about as big as an ottoman, and festooned variously with stars and stripes, hammers and sickles. It was witnessed by a huge fraction of the world population. The evening television news programs regularly counted how many strategic weapons on both sides had been disassembled. How many more to go? In a little over two decades, this news too would reach Vega. In the following years, the divestitures continued, almost without a hitch. At first, the fat in the arsenals was surrendered, with little change in strategic doctrine. But now the cuts were being felt, and the most destabilizing weapons systems were being dismantled. It was something the experts had called impossible and declared contrary to human nature. But a sentence of death, as Samuel Johnson had noted, concentrates the mind wonderfully. In the past half year, the dismantling of nuclear weapons by the United States and the Soviet Union had made major new strides, with fairly intrusive inspection teams of each nation soon to be installed on the territory of the other. Despite the disapproval and concern publicly voiced by the military staffs of both nations, the United Nations found itself unexpectedly effective in mediating international disputes with the West Iran and the Chile-Argentina border wars, both apparently resolved. There was even talk, not all of it fatuous, of a non-aggression treaty between NATO and the Warsaw Pact. The delegates arriving in the first plenary session of the World Message Consortium were predisposed toward cordiality to an extent unparalleled in recent decades. Every nation, with even a handful of message bits, was represented, sending both scientific and political delegates. A surprising number sent military representatives as well. In a few cases, national delegations were led by foreign ministers or even heads of state. The United Kingdom delegation included Viscount Boxforth, the Lord Privy Seal, an honorific Ellie privately found hilarious. The USSR delegation was headed by B. Ya Abukimov, president of the Soviet Academy of Sciences, with Godzrichev, the minister of medium heavy industry, and Arkhangelsky playing significant roles. The President of the United States had insisted that Trahir head the American delegation, although it included Under Secretary of State Elmo Honeycutt and Michael Kitts, among others, for the Department of Defense. A vast and elaborate map in equal area projection showed the disposition of radio telescopes over the planet, including the Soviet ocean-going tracking vessels. Ellie glanced around the newly completed conference hall, adjacent to the offices and residence of the President of France. In only the second year of his 7-year term, he was making every effort to guarantee the meeting's success. A multitude of faces, flags, and national dress was reflected off the long, arcing mahogany tables and the mirrored walls. She recognized few of the political and military people, but in every delegation, there seemed to be at least one familiar scientist or engineer. Annunziata and Ian Broderick from Australia. Fedirka from Czechoslovakia. Brod, Crepillon, and Boileau from France. Kumar Chandrapurana and Devi Sukhavati from India. Hiranaga and Matsui from Japan. Ellie reflected on the strong technological, rather than radio-astronomical background of many of the delegates, especially the Japanese. The idea that the construction of some vast machine might be on the agenda of this meeting had motivated last-minute changes in the composition of delegates. She also recognized Malatesta of Italy, Biedenbaugh, a physicist fallen into politics, Clegg, and the venerable Sir Arthur Chaitos, chatting behind the sort of Union Jack one can find on restaurant tables in European resorts. Jaime Ortiz of Spain. Prebula from Switzerland, which was puzzling since Switzerland did not, so far as she knew, even have a radio telescope. Bao, who had done brilliantly in putting together the Chinese radio telescope array. Wintergarden from Sweden. There were surprisingly large Saudi, Pakistani, and Iraqi delegations. And, of course, the Soviets, among whom Nadia Rozhdestvenskaya and Genrikh Arkhangelsky were sharing a moment of genuine hilarity. Ellie looked for Lunacharsky and finally spotted him with the Chinese delegation. He was shaking hands with Yu Renquang, the director of the Beijing Radio Observatory. She recalled that the two men had been friends and colleagues during the period of Sino-Soviet cooperation, but the hostilities between their two nations had ended all contact between them, and Chinese restrictions on foreign travel by their senior scientists were still almost as severe as Soviet constraints. She was witnessing, she realized, their first meeting in perhaps a quarter century.
"Who's the old China person Vega's shaking hands with?"
This was for Kitts an attempt at cordiality. He had been making small offerings of this sort for the last few days, a development she regarded as unpromising.
You, director of the Beijing Observatory.
Oh, I thought those guys hated each other's guts.
Michael, she said, the world is both better and worse than you imagine.
Eh, you can probably beat me on better, he replied. But you can't hold a candle to me on worse.
After the welcome by the President of France, who, to mild astonishment, stayed to hear the opening presentations, and a discussion of procedure and agenda by Jahir and Aboukimov as conference co-chairman, Ellie and Vega together summarized the data. They made what were by now standard presentations, not too technical because of the political and military people, of how radio telescopes work, the distribution of nearby stars in space, and the history of the palimpsest message. Their tandem presentation concluded with a survey, displayed on the monitors before each delegation, of the diagrammatic material recently received. She was careful to show how the polarization modulation was converted into a sequence of zeros and ones, how the zeros and ones fit together to make a picture, and how in most cases they had not the vaguest notion of what the picture conveyed. The data points reassembled themselves on the computer screens. She could see faces illuminated in white, amber, and green by the monitors in the now partly darkened hall. The diagrams showed intricate branching networks, lumpy, almost indecently biological forms. A perfectly formed, regular, dodecahedron. A long series of pages had been reassembled into an elaborately detailed three-dimensional construction which slowly rotated. Each enigmatic object was joined by an unintelligible caption. Vege stressed the uncertainty still more strongly than she did. Nevertheless, it was, in his opinion, now beyond doubt that the message was a handbook for the construction of a machine. He neglected to mention that the idea of the message as a blueprint had originally been his and Arkhangelsky's, and Ellie seized the opportunity to rectify the oversight. She had talked about the subject enough over the past few months to know that both scientific and general audiences were often fascinated by the details of the unraveling of the message, and tantalized by the still unproved concept of a primer. But she was unprepared for the response from this, one would expect, staid audience. Vege and she had interdigitated their presentations. As they finished, there was a sustained thunder of applause. The Soviets and Eastern European delegations applauded in unison, with a frequency of about 2 or 3 hand claps per heartbeat. The Americans and many others applauded separately, their unsynchronized clapping a sea of white noise rising from the crowd. Enveloped by an unfamiliar kind of joy, she could not resist thinking about the differences in national character, the Americans as individualists, and the Russians engaged in a collective endeavor. Also, she recalled that Americans in crowds tried to maximize their distance from their fellows, while Soviets tended to lean on each other as much as possible. Both styles of applause, the American clearly dominant, delighted her. For just a moment, she permitted herself to think about her stepfather and her father. After lunch, there was a succession of other presentations on the data collection and interpretation. David Drumlin gave an extraordinarily capable discussion of a statistical analysis he had recently performed of all previous pages of the message that referred to the new number diagrams. He argued that the message contained not just a blueprint for building a machine, but also descriptions of the designs and means of fabrication of components and subcomponents. In a few cases, he thought, there were descriptions of whole new industries not yet known on Earth. Ellie, mouth agape, shook her finger toward Drumlin, silently asking Valerian whether he had known about this. His lips pursed. Valerian hunched his shoulders and rotated his hands, palms up. She scanned the other delegates for some expression of emotion, but could detect mainly signs of fatigue, the depth of technical material, and the necessity sooner or later of making political decisions were already producing strain. After the session, she complimented Drumlin on the interpretation, but asked why she had not heard of it until now. He replied before walking away, "Oh, I didn't think it was important enough to bother you with. It was just a little something I did while you were out consulting religious fanatics." If Drumlin had been her thesis advisor, she would still be pursuing her PhD, she thought. He had never fully accepted her. They would never share an easygoing, collegial relationship. Sighing, she wondered whether Ken had known about Drumlin's new work. But as conference co-chairman, Drahir was sitting with his Soviet opposite number on a raised dais facing the horseshoe of delegate tiers. He was, as he had been for weeks, nearly inaccessible. Drumlin was not obliged to discuss his findings with her, of course. She knew they both had been preoccupied recently. But in conversation with him, why was she always accommodating and argumentative only in extremis? A part of her evidently felt that the granting of her doctorate and the opportunity to pursue her science were still future possibilities, firmly in Drumlin's hands. On the morning of the second day, a Soviet delegate was given the floor. He was unknown to her. Stefan Alexievich Baruda, the vitagraphics on her computer screen read out. Director, Institute for Peace Studies, Soviet Academy of Sciences, Moscow. Member, Central Committee, Communist Party of the USSR. Now we start to play hardball, she heard Michael Kitt say to Elmo Honeycutt, the State Department. Baruta was a dapper man, wearing an elegantly tailored and impeccably fashionable Western business suit, perhaps of Italian cut. His English was fluent and almost unaccented. He had been born in one of the Baltic republics, was young to be head of such an important organization, formed to study the long-term implications for strategic policy of the deaccessioning of nuclear weapons, and was a leading example of the new wave in the Soviet leadership. Let us be frank, Baruta was saying. A message is being sent to us from the far reaches of space. Most of the information has been gathered by the Soviet Union and the United States. Essential pieces have also been obtained by other countries. All of those countries are represented at this conference. Any one nation, the Soviet Union, for example, could have waited until the message repeated itself several times, as we all hope it will, and fill in the many missing pieces in such a way. But it would take years, perhaps decades, and we are a little impatient. So we have all shared the data. Any one nation, the Soviet Union, for example, could place into orbit around the Earth large radio telescopes with sensitive receivers that work at the frequencies of the message. The Americans could do this as well. Perhaps Japan or France or the European Space Agency could. Then any one nation by itself could acquire all the data. Because in space, a radio telescope can point at Vega all the time. But that might be thought a hostile act. It is no secret that the United States or the Soviet Union might be able to shoot down such satellites. So perhaps for this reason, too, we have all shared the data. It is better to cooperate. Our scientists wish to exchange not only the data they have gathered, but also their speculations, their guesses, their dreams. All you scientists are alike in that respect. I am not a scientist. My specialty is government. So I know that the nations are also alike. Every nation is cautious. Every nation is suspicious. None of us would give an advantage to a potential adversary if we could prevent it. And so there have been two opinions. Well, perhaps more, but at least two. One that counsels exchange of all the data, and another that counsels each nation to seek advantage over the other. You can be sure the other side is seeking some advantage, they say. It is the same in most countries. The scientists have won this debate. So, for example, most of the data, although I wish to point out not all, acquired by the United States and the Soviet Union have been exchanged. Most of the data from all other countries have been exchanged worldwide. We are happy we have made this decision. Ellie whispered to Kitts, This doesn't sound like hardball to me. Stay tuned, he whispered back. But there are other kinds of dangers. We would like now to raise one of them for the consortium to consider. Baruta's tone reminded her of Vegas at lunch the other day. What was the bee in the Soviet bonnet? We have heard Academician Lunacharsky, Dr. Arroway, and other scientists agree that we are receiving the instructions for building a complex machine. Suppose that, as everyone seems to expect, the end of the message comes. The message recycles to the beginning, and we receive the introduction, or the English word is primer? Primer, which lets us read the message. Suppose also that we continue to cooperate fully, all of us. We exchange all the data, all the fantasies, all the dreams. Now the beings on Vega, they are not sending us these instructions for their amusement. They want us to build a machine. Perhaps they will tell us what the machine is supposed to do, perhaps not. But even if they do, why should we believe them? So I raise my own fantasy, my own dream. It is not a happy one. What if this machine is a Trojan horse? We build the machine at great expense. Turn it on and suddenly an invading army pours out of it. Or what if it is a doomsday machine? We build it, turn it on, and the earth blows up. Perhaps this is their way to suppress civilizations just emerging into the cosmos. It would not cost much.
They pay only for a telegram.
And the upstart civilization obediently destroys itself. What I am about to ask is only a suggestion, a talking point. I raise it for your consideration. I mean it to be constructive. On this issue, we all share the same planet. We all have the same interests. No doubt I will put it too bluntly. Here is my question. Would it be better to burn the data and destroy the radio telescopes? A commotion ensued. Many delegations asked simultaneously to be recognized. Instead, the conference co-chairman seemed mainly motivated to remind the delegates that sessions were not to be recorded or videotaped. No interviews were to be granted to the press. There would be daily press releases agreed upon by the conference co-chairman and the leaders of delegations. Even the integuments of the present discussion were to remain in this conference chamber. Several delegates asked for clarification from the chair.
"If Baruda is right about a Trojan horse or a doomsday machine," shouted out a Dutch delegate, "isn't it our duty to inform the public?"
But he had not been recognized, and his microphone had not been activated. They went on to other, more urgent matters. Ellie had quickly punched into the institutional computer terminal before her for an early position in the queue. She discovered that she was scheduled second, after Sukhavati, and before one of the Chinese delegates. Ellie knew Devi Sukhavati slightly. A stately woman in her mid-40s, she was wearing a Western coiffure, high-heeled slingback pumps, and an exquisite silk sari. Originally trained as a physician, she had become one of the leading Indian experts in molecular biology, and now shared her time between King's College, Cambridge, and the Tata Institute in Bombay. She was one of a handful of Indian fellows of the Royal Society of London, and was said to be well-placed politically. They had last met a few years before at an international symposium in Tokyo, before receipt of the message had eliminated the obligatory question marks in the titles of some of their scientific papers. Ellie had sensed a mutual affinity, due only in part to the fact that they were among the few women participating in scientific meetings on extraterrestrial life.
"I recognize that academician Baruda has raised an important and sensitive issue," Sukhavati began. "And it would be foolish to dismiss the Trojan horse possibility carelessly. Given most of recent history, this is a natural idea, and I'm surprised it took so long to be raised. However, I would like to caution against such fears. It is unlikely in the extreme that the beings on a planet of the star Vega are exactly at our level of technological advance. Even on our planet, cultures do not evolve in lockstep. Some start earlier, others later. I recognize that some cultures can catch up at least technologically. When there were high civilizations in India, China, Iraq, and Egypt, there were, at best, Iron Age nomads in Europe and Russia, and Stone Age cultures in America. But the differences in the technologies will be much greater in the present circumstances. The extraterrestrials are likely to be far ahead of us. Certainly more than a few hundred years farther along, perhaps thousands of years ahead of us, or even millions. Now I ask you to compare that with the pace of human technological advancement in the last century. I grew up in a tiny village in South India. In my grandmother's time, the treadle sewing machine was a technological wonder. What would beings who are thousands of years ahead of us be capable of? Or millions? As a philosopher in our part of the world once said, the artifacts of a sufficiently advanced extraterrestrial civilization would be indistinguishable from magic. We can pose no threat to them whatever. They have nothing to fear from us, and that will be true for a very long time. This is no confrontation between Greeks and Trojans who are evenly matched. This is no science fiction movie where beings from different planets fight with similar weapons. If they wish to destroy us, they can certainly do so with or without our
But at what cost?
Someone interrupted from the floor.
Don't you see? That's the point. Baruda's saying our television broadcasts to space are there notice that it's time to destroy us.
And the message is the means. Punitive expeditions are dear. The message is cheap.
Ellie could not make out who had shouted out this intervention. It seemed to be someone in the British delegation. His remarks had not been amplified by the audio system, because again the speaker had not been recognized by the chair. But the acoustics in the conference hall were sufficiently good that he could be heard perfectly well. Drahir, in the chair, tried to keep order. Abukimov leaned over and whispered something to an aide.
"You think there is a danger in building the machine?"
Sukhavati replied.
"I think there is a danger in not building the machine. I would be ashamed of our planet if we turned our back on the future. Your ancestors."
She shook a finger at her interlocutor.
"Were not so timid when they first set sail for India or America."
This meeting was getting to be full of surprises, Ellie thought, although she doubted whether Clive or Raleigh were the best role models for present decision-making. Perhaps Sukhavati was only tweaking the British for past colonial offenses. She waited for the green speaker's light on her console to illuminate, indicating that her microphone was activated.
"Mr. Chairman,"
she found herself in this formal and public posture addressing Drahir, whom she had hardly seen in the last few days. They had arranged to spend tomorrow afternoon together during a break in the meeting, and she felt some anxiety about what they would say. Oops. Wrong thought, she thought.
Mr. Chairman, I believe we can shed some light on these two questions, the Trojan horse and the doomsday machine. I had intended to discuss this tomorrow morning, but it certainly seems relevant now.
On her console, she punched in the code numbers for a few of her slides. The great mirrored hall darkened.
Dr. Lunacharsky and I are convinced that these are different projections of the same three-dimensional configuration. We showed the entire configuration in computer-simulated rotation yesterday. We think, though we can't be sure, that this is what the interior of the machine will look like. There is as yet no clear indication of scale. Maybe it's a kilometer across. Maybe it's sub-microscopic.
But notice these five objects evenly spaced around the periphery of the main interior chamber, inside the dodecahedron. Here's a close-up of one of them. They're the only things in the chamber that look at all recognizable.
This appears to be an ordinary overstuffed armchair, perfectly configured for a human being. It's very unlikely that extraterrestrial beings evolved on another quite different world would resemble us sufficiently to share our preferences in living room furniture. Here, look at this close-up. It looks like something from my mother's spare room when I was growing up.
Indeed, it almost seemed to have flowered slipcovers. A small flutter of guilt entered her mind. She had neglected to call her mother before leaving for Europe, and if truth be told, had called her only once or twice since the message was received. Ellie, how could you? She remonstrated with herself.
End of side 9.
Side 10.
She looked again at the computer graphics. The five-fold symmetry of the dodecahedron was reflected in the five interior chairs, each facing a pentagonal surface.
"So it's our contention, Dr. Lunacharsky and I, that the five chairs are meant for us, for people. That would mean that the interior chamber of the machine is only a few meters across, the exterior perhaps 10 or 20 meters across. The technology is undoubtedly formidable, but we don't think we're talking about building something the size of a city or as complex as an aircraft carrier. We might very well be able to build this, whatever it is, if we all work together. What I'm trying to say is that you don't put chairs inside a bomb. I don't think this is a doomsday machine or a Trojan horse. I agree with what Dr. Sukhavati said, or maybe only implied. The idea that this is a Trojan horse is itself an indication of how far we have to go." Again, there was an outburst. But this time, Drahir made no effort to stop it. Indeed, he actually turned the complainant's microphone on. It was the same delegate
who had interrupted Sukhavati a few minutes earlier. Philip Beedenbaugh of the United Kingdom, a Labour Party minister in the shaky coalition government.
"Simply doesn't understand what our concern is. If it was literally a wooden horse, we would not be tempted to bring the alien device within the city gates. We have read our Homer, but flounce it up with some upholstery, and our suspicions are allayed. Why? Because we are being flattered or bribed. There's an historic adventure implied. There's the promise of new technologies. There's a hint of acceptance by, how to put it, greater beings. But I say no matter what lofty fantasies the radio astronomers may entertain, if there is even a tiny chance the machine is a means of destruction, it should not be built. Better, as the Soviet delegate has proposed, to burn the data tapes and make the construction of radio telescopes a capital crime." The meeting was becoming unruly. Scores of delegates were electronically queuing for authorization to speak. The hubbub rose to a subdued roar that reminded Ellie of her years of listening to radio astronomical static. A consensus did not seem readily within reach, and the co-chairmen were clearly unable to restrain the delegates. As the Chinese delegate rose to speak, the vitagraphics were slow to appear on Ellie's screen, and she looked around for help. She had no idea who this man was either. Nian Bobby Bui, a National Security Council staffer, now assigned to Dirhir, leaned over and said, "Shi Kamyu's his name, spelled X-I, pronounced Shi. Heavy dude, born on the Long March. Volunteer as a teenager in Korea. Government official, mainly political. Knocked down for a 9-count in the Cultural Revolution. Central Committee member now. Very influential. Been in the news lately. Also directs Chinese archaeological digging." Shi Kuamyu was a tall, broad-shouldered man around 60. The wrinkles on his face made him seem older, but his posture and physique gave him an almost youthful appearance. He wore his tunic buttoned at the collar in the fashion that was as obligatory for Chinese political leaders as three-piece suits were for American governmental leaders. The president, of course, accepted. The vitagraphics now came through on her console, and she could remember having read a long article about Shi Kuamyu in one of the video news magazines. "If we are frightened," he was saying, "we will do nothing. That will delay them a little. But remember, they know we are here. Our television arrives at their planet. Every day they are reminded of us. Have you looked at our television programs? They will not forget us. If we do nothing, and if they are worried about us, they will come to us, machine or no machine. We cannot hide from them. If we had kept quiet, we would not face this problem. If we had cable television only, and no big military radar, then maybe they would not know about us. But now it is too late. We cannot go back. Our course is set. If you are seriously frightened about this machine destroying the Earth, do not build it on the Earth. Build it somewhere else. Then, if it is a doomsday machine and blows up a world, it will not be our world. But this will be very expensive, probably too expensive. Or if we are not so frightened, build it in some isolated desert. You could have a very big explosion in the Tokopi wasteland in Xinjiang province and still kill nobody. And if we are not frightened at all, we can build it in Washington, or Moscow, or Beijing, or in this beautiful city. In ancient China, Vega and two nearby stars were called Qianyu. It means the young woman with the spinning wheel. It is an auspicious symbol, a machine to make new clothes for the people of the Earth. We have received an invitation, a very unusual invitation. Maybe it is to go to a banquet. The Earth has never been invited to a banquet before. It would be impolite to refuse. Chapter 12. The One Delta Isomer. Looking at the stars always makes me dream, as simply as I dream over the black dots
representing towns and villages on a map. Why, I ask myself, shouldn't the shining dots of the sky be as accessible as the black dots on the map of France? Vincent van Gogh. It was a splendid autumn afternoon, so unseasonably warm that Devi Sukhavati had left her coat behind. She and Ellie walked along the crowded Champs-Élysées toward the Place de la Concorde. The ethnic diversity was rivaled by London, Manhattan, and only a few other cities on the planet. Two women walking together, one in a skirt and sweater, the other in a sari, were in no way unusual. Outside a tobacconist's, there was a long, orderly, and polyglot line of people attracted by the first week of legalized sale of cured cannabis cigarettes from the United States. By French law, they could not be sold to or consumed by those under 18 years of age. Many in line were middle-aged and older. Some might have been naturalized Algerians or Moroccans. Especially potent varieties of cannabis were grown, mainly in California and Oregon, for the export trade. Featured here was a new and admired strain, which had, in addition, been grown in ultraviolet light, converting some of the inert cannabinoids into the 1-delta isomer. It was called Sunkissed. The package, illustrated in a window display a meter and a half high, bore in French the slogan, "This will be deducted from your share in paradise." The shop windows along the boulevard were a riot of color. The two women bought chestnuts from a street vendor and reveled in the taste and texture. For some reason, every time Ellie saw a sign advertising BNP, the Banque Nationale de Paris, she read it as the Russian word for beer, with the middle letter inverted left to right. Beer. The signs, lately corrupted from their usual and respectable fiduciary vocations, seemed to be exhorting her. Russian beer. The incongruity amused her, and only with difficulty could she convince the part of her brain in charge of reading that this was the Latin, not the Cyrillic alphabet. Further on, they marveled at l'obélisque, an ancient military commemorative, stolen at great expense to become a modern military commemorative. They decided to walk on. Durhir had broken the date, or at least that's what it amounted to. He had called her up this morning, apologetic, but not desperately so. There were too many political issues being raised at the plenary session. The Secretary of State was flying in tomorrow, interrupting a visit to Cuba. Jahir's hands were full, and he hoped Ellie would understand. She understood. She hated herself for sleeping with him. To avoid an afternoon alone, she had dialed Devi Sukhavati. One of the Sanskrit words for victorious is Abhijit. That's what Vega was called in ancient India, Abhijit. It was under the influence of Vega that the Hindu divinities, our culture heroes, conquered the Asuras, the gods of evil. Ellie, are you listening? Now, it's a curious thing. In Persia there are Asuras also, but in Persia the Asuras were the gods of good. Eventually religion sprang up in which the chief god, the god of light, the sun god, was called Ahura Mazda. The Zoroastrians, for example, and the Mithraists. Ahura, Asura, it's the same name. There are still Zoroastrians today, and the Mithraists gave the early Christians a good fright. But in the same story, those Hindu divinities, they were mainly female, by the way, were called Devis. Where's the origin of my own name? In India, the Devis are gods of good. In Persia, the Devis become gods of evil. Some scholars think this is where the English word devil ultimately comes from. The symmetry is complete. All this is probably some vaguely remembered account of the Aryan invasion that pushed the Dravidians, my ancestors, to the south. So depending on which side of the Kirtar range one lives on, Vega supports either God or the devil. This cheerful story had been proffered as a gift by Devi, who clearly had heard something of Ellie's California religious adventures 2 weeks before. Ellie was grateful. But it reminded her that she had not even mentioned to Joss the possibility that the message was the blueprint for a machine of unknown purpose. Now he would soon enough be hearing all this through the media.
She should really, she told herself sternly, make an overseas call to explain to him the new developments. But Joss was said to be in seclusion. He had offered no public statement following their meeting in Modesto. Rankin, in a press conference, announced that while there might be some dangers, he was not opposed to letting the scientists receive the full message. But translation was another matter. Periodic review by all segments of society was required, he said, especially by those entrusted to safeguard spiritual and moral values. They were now approaching the Tuileries Gardens, where the garish hues of autumn were on display. Frail and elderly men, Ellie judged them to be from Southeast Asia, were in vigorous dispute. Ornamenting the black cast-iron gates were multicolored balloons on sail. At the center of a pool of water was a marble amphitrite. Around her, toy sailboats were racing, urged on by an exuberant crowd of small children with Magellanic aspirations. A catfish suddenly broke water, swamping the lead boat, and the boys and girls became subdued, chastened by this wholly unexpected apparition. The sun was low in the west, and Ellie felt a momentary chill. They approached L'Orangerie, in the annex of which was a special exhibition, so the poster proclaimed, Image Martienne. The joint American-French-Soviet robot roving vehicles on Mars had produced a spectacular windfall of color photographs. Some, like the Voyager images of the outer solar system around 1980, soaring beyond their mere scientific purpose and becoming art. The poster featured a landscape photographed on the vast Elysium Plateau. In the foreground was a three-sided pyramid, smooth, highly eroded, with an impact crater near the base. It had been produced by millions of years of high-speed sandblasting by the fierce Martian winds, the planetary geologists had said. A second rover, assigned to Sidonia on the other side of Mars, had become mired in a drifting dune, and its controllers in Pasadena had been so far unable to respond to its forlorn cries for help. Ellie found herself riveted on Sukhavati's appearance. Her huge black eyes, erect bearing, and yet another magnificent sari. She thought to herself, I'm not graceful. Usually she found herself able to continue her part of a conversation while mentally addressing other matters as well. But today she had trouble following one line of thought, never mind two. While they were discussing the merits of the several opinions on whether to build the machine, in her mind's eye, she returned to Davy's image from the Aryan invasion of India 3,500 years ago. A war between two peoples, each of whom claimed victory, each of whom patriotically exaggerated the historical accounts. Ultimately, the story is transformed into a war of the gods. Our side, of course, is good. The other side, of course, is evil. She imagined the goateed, spade-tailed, cloven-hoofed devil of the West evolving by slow evolutionary steps over thousands of years from some Hindu antecedent who, for all Ellie knew, had the head of an elephant and was painted blue. Baruda's Trojan horse? Maybe it's not a completely foolish idea, she found herself saying. But I don't see that we have any choice, as she said. They can be here in 20-some-odd years if they want to. They arrived at a monumental arch, in the Roman style, surmounted by a heroic, indeed apotheotic statue of Napoleon as chariot driver. From the long view, from an extraterrestrial perspective, how pathetic this posturing was. They rested on a nearby bench, their long shadows cast over a bed of flowers, planted in the colors of the French Republic. Ellie longed to discuss her own emotional predicament, but that might have political overtones. It would at the very least be indiscreet. She did not know Sukhavati very well. Instead, she encouraged her companion to speak about her personal life. Sukhavati acquiesced readily enough. She had been born to a Brahmin but unprosperous family with matriarchal proclivities in the southern state of Tamil Nadu. Matriarchal households were still common all over South India. She matriculated at Banaras Hindu University. At medical school in England, she had met and fallen deeply in love with Surinder Ghosh, a fellow medical student. But Surinder was a Harijan, an untouchable, of a caste so loathed that the mere sight of them was held by orthodox Brahmins to be polluting. Surinder's ancestors had been forced to live a nocturnal existence, like bats and owls. Her family threatened to disown her if they married. Her father declared that he had no daughter who would consider such a union. If she married Ghosh, he would mourn her as though she were dead. She married him anyway. "We were too much in love," she said. "I really had no choice." Within the year, he died from septicemia, acquired while performing an autopsy under inadequate supervision. Instead of reconciling her to her family, however, Surinder's death accomplished the opposite, and after receiving her medical degree, Devi decided to remain in England. She discovered a natural affinity for molecular biology and considered it an effortless continuation of her medical studies. She soon found she had real talent in this meticulous discipline. Knowledge of nucleic acid replication led her to work on the origin of life, and that in turn led her to consider life on other planets.
"You could say that my scientific career has been a sequence of free associations. One thing just led to another."
She had recently been working on the characterization of Martian organic matter, measured in a few locales on Mars, by the same roving vehicles whose stunning photographic products they had just seen advertised. Devi had never remarried, although she made it plain there were some who pursued her. Lately she had been seeing a scientist in Bombay, whom she described as a computerwala. Walking a little farther on, they found themselves in the Cœur Napoléon, the interior courtyard of the Louvre Museum. In its center was the newly completed and wildly controversial pyramidal entrance, and in high niches around the courtyard were sculptural representations of the heroes of French civilization. Captured under each statue of a revered man, they could see little evidence of revered women, was his surname. Occasionally, letters were eroded by natural weathering, or in a few cases perhaps effaced by some offended passerby. For one or two statues, it was difficult to piece together who the savant had been. On the statue that had evidently evoked the greatest public resentment, only the letters LTA remained. Although the sun was setting and the Louvre was open until mid-evening, they did not enter, but instead ambled along the Seine embankment, following the river back along the Quai d'Orsay. The proprietors of bookstalls were fastening shutters and closing up shop for the day. For a while they strolled on, arm in arm in the European manner. A French couple was walking a few paces ahead of them, each parent holding one hand of their daughter, a girl of about 4, who would periodically launch herself off the pavement. In her momentary suspension in 0G, she experienced, it was apparent, something akin to ecstasy. The parents were discussing the World Message Consortium, which was hardly a coincidence since the newspapers had been full of little else. The man was for building the machine. It might create new technologies and increase employment in France. The woman was more cautious, but for reasons she had difficulty articulating. The daughter, braids flying, was wholly unconcerned about what to do with a blueprint from the stars. Derheer, Kitts, and Honeycutt had called a meeting at the American Embassy early the following morning to prepare for the arrival of the Secretary of State later in the day. The meeting was to be classified and held in the embassy's black room, a chamber electromagnetically decoupled from the outside world, making even sophisticated electronic surveillance impossible. Or so it was claimed.
Ellie thought there might be instrumentation developed that could make an end run around these precautions. After spending the afternoon with Devi Sukhavati, she had received the message at her hotel and had tried to call her here, but was able only to reach Michael Kitts. She opposed a classified meeting on this subject, she said. It was a matter of principle. The message was clearly intended for the entire planet. Kitts replied that there were no data being withheld from the rest of the world, at least by Americans, and that the meeting was merely advisory, to assist the United States in the difficult procedural negotiations ahead. He appealed to her patriotism, to her self-interest, and at last invoked again the Haddon decision. "For all I know, that thing is still sitting in your safe unread. Read it," he urged. She tried again unsuccessfully to reach her here. First, the man turns up everywhere in the Argus facility like a bad penny. He moves in with you in your apartment. You're sure, for the first time in years, you're in love. The next minute, you can't even get him to answer the phone. She decided to attend the meeting, if only to see Ken face to face. Kitts was enthusiastically for building the machine. Drumlin, cautiously in favor. Terheer and Honeycutt, at least outwardly uncommitted. And Peter Valerian in an agony of indecision. Kitts and Drumlin were even talking about where to build the thing. Freightage costs alone made manufacture or even assembly on the far side of the moon prohibitively expensive, as she had guessed. "If we use aerodynamic braking, it's cheaper to send a kilogram to Phobos or Deimos than to the far side of the moon," Bobby Bui volunteered. "Where the hell is Phobos or Deimos?" Kitts wanted to know. "The moon's a Mars. I was talking about aerodynamic braking in the Martian atmosphere." "And, how long does it take to get to Phobos or Deimos?" Drumlin was stirring his cup of coffee. "Maybe a year, but once we have a fleet of interplanetary transfer vehicles and the pipeline is full, compared with 3 days to the moon," sputtered Drumlin. "Bui, stop wasting our time." "It's only a suggestion," he protested. "You know, just something to think about." Terheer seemed impatient, distracted. He was clearly under great pressure, alternately avoiding her eyes and, she thought, making some unspoken appeal. She took it as a hopeful sign. "If you want to worry about doomsday machines," Drumlin was saying, "you have to worry about energy supplies. If it doesn't have access to an enormous amount of energy, it can't be a doomsday machine. So as long as the instructions don't ask for a gigawatt nuclear reactor, I don't think we have to worry about doomsday machines." "Why are you guys in such a hurry to commit to construction?" she asked Kitts and Drumlin collectively. They were sitting next to each other, with a plate of croissant between them. Kitts looked from Honeycutt to Terheer before answering. "This is a classified meeting," he began. "We all know you won't pass anything said here on to your Russian friends. It's like this. We don't know what the machine will do, but it's clear from Dave Drumlin's analysis that there's new technology in it, probably new industries. Constructing the machine is bound to have economic value. I mean, think of what we'd learn. And it might have military value. At least that's what the Russians are thinking. See, the Russians are in a box. Here's a whole new area of technology they're going to have to keep up with the U.S. on. Maybe there's instructions for some decisive weapon in the message or some economic advantage. They can't be sure. They'll have to bust their economy trying. Did you notice how Baruda kept referring to what was cost-effective? If all this message stuff went away, burn the data, destroy the telescopes, then the Russians could maintain military parity. That's why they're so cautious. So, of course, that's why we're gung-ho for it." He smiled. Temperamentally, Kitts was bloodless, she thought. But he was far from stupid. When he was cold and withdrawn, people tended not to like him. So he had developed an occasional veneer of urbane amiability. In Ellie's view, it was a molecular monolayer thick. "Now let me ask you a question," he continued. "Did you catch Baruda's remark about withholding some of the data? Is there any missing data?"
Only from very early on, she replied. Only from the first few weeks, I guess. There were a few holes in the Chinese coverage a little after that. There's still a small amount of data that hasn't been exchanged on all sides. But I don't see any signs of Sirius holding back. Anyway, we'll pick up any missing data swatches after the message recycles.
If the message recycles, Drumlin growled.
Jurhir moderated a discussion on contingency planning, what to do when the primer was received, which American, German, and Japanese industries to notify early about possible major development projects, how to identify key scientists and engineers for constructing the machine, if the decision was made to go ahead, and, briefly, the need to build enthusiasm for the project in Congress and with the American public. Jurhir hastened to add that these would be contingency plans only, that no final decision was being made, and that no doubt Soviet concerns about a Trojan horse were at least partly genuine. Kitz asked about the composition of the crew. They're asking us to put people in 5 upholstered chairs. Which people? How do we decide? It'll probably have to be an international crew. How many Americans? How many Russians? Anybody else? We don't know what happens to those 5 people when they sit down in those chairs, but we want to have the best men for the job. Ellie did not rise to the bait, and he continued. Now a major question is going to be who pays for what? Who builds what? Who's in charge of overall systems integration? I think we can do some real horse trading on this, in exchange for significant American representation in the crew.
But we still want to send the best possible people, Jurhir noted a little obviously.
Sure, returned Kitz. But what do we mean by best? Scientists? People with military intelligence backgrounds? Physical strength and endurance? Patriotism? That's not a dirty word, you know. And then, he looked up from buttering another croissant to glance directly at Ellie. There's the question of sex. Sexes, I mean. Do we send only men? If it's men and women, there has to be more of one sex than the other. There's 5 places, an odd number. Are all the crew members going to work together okay? If we go ahead with this project, there's going to be a lot of tough negotiation.
This doesn't sound right to me, said Ellie. This isn't some ambassadorship you buy with a campaign contribution. This is serious business. Also, do you want some muscle-bound moron up there? Some kid in his 20s who knows nothing about how the world works? Just how to run a respectable 100-yard dash and how to obey orders? Or some political hack? That can't be what this trip is about.
No, you're right. Kit smiled. I think we'll find people who satisfy all our criteria.
Jurhir, the bags under his eyes, making him look almost haggard, adjourned the meeting. He managed to give Ellie a small, private smile, but it was all lips, no teeth. The embassy limousines were waiting to take them back to the Elysee Palace.
I'll tell you why it would be better to send Russians, Vege was saying. When you Americans were opening up your country, pioneers, trappers, Indian scouts, all that, you were unopposed, at least by anyone at your level of technology. You raced across your continent from the Atlantic to the Pacific. After a while, you expected everything would be easy. Our situation was different. We were conquered by the Mongols. Their horse technology was much superior to ours. When we expanded eastward, we were careful. We never crossed the wilderness and expected it would be easy. We're more adjusted to adversity than you are. Also, Americans are used to being ahead technologically. We're used to catching up technologically. Now everybody on Earth is a Russian. You understand? I mean, in our historical position. This mission needs Soviets more than it needs Americans.
Merely meeting with her alone entailed certain risks for Vege, and for her as well, as Kitz had gone out of his way to remind her. Sometimes, during a scientific meeting in America or Europe, Vege would be permitted to spend an afternoon with her. More often, he was accompanied by colleagues or a KGB babysitter, who would be described as a translator, even when his English was clearly inferior to Vege's, or as a scientist from the secretariat of this or that academy commission,
except that his knowledge of the scientific matters often proved superficial. Vege would shake his head when asked about them. But, by and large, he considered the babysitters a part of the game, the price you must pay when they let you visit the West. And more than once she thought she detected a note of affection in Vege's voice when he talked to the babysitter. To go to a foreign country and pretend to be expert in a subject you know poorly must be filled with anxiety. Perhaps in their heart of hearts, the babysitters detested their assignment as much as Vege did. They were seated at the same window table at Chez Dieu. A distinct chill was in the air, a premonition of winter, and a young man wearing a long blue scarf as his only concession to the cold strode briskly past the tubs of chilled oysters outside the window. From Lunacharsky's continuing and uncharacteristically guarded remarks, she deduced disarray in the Soviet delegation. The Soviets were concerned that the machine might somehow redound to the strategic advantage of the United States in the five-decade-old global competition. Vege had, in fact, been shocked by Baruda's question about burning the data and destroying the radio telescopes. He had had no advance knowledge of Baruda's position.
The Soviets had played a vital role in gathering the message with the largest longitudinal coverage of any nation,
Vege stressed. And they had the only serious ocean-going radio telescopes. They would expect a major role in whatever came next. Ellie assured him that as far as she was concerned, they should have such a role. Look, Vege, they know from our television transmissions that the Earth rotates, and that there are many different nations. The Olympic broadcast alone might have told them that. Subsequent transmissions from other nations would have nailed it down. So if they're as good as we think, they could have phased the transmission with the Earth's rotation. So only one nation got the message. They chose not to do that. They want the message to be received by everybody on the planet. They're expecting the machine to be built by the whole planet. This can't be an all-American or an all-Russian project. It's not what our client wants. But she was not sure, she told him, that she would be playing any role in decisions on machine construction or crew selection. She was returning to the United States the next day, mainly to get on top of the new radio data from the past few weeks. The consortium plenary sessions seemed interminable, and no closing date had been set. Vege had been asked by his people to stay on at least a little longer. The foreign minister had just arrived and was now leading the Soviet delegation.
"I'm worried all this will end badly," he said. "There are so many things that can go wrong. Technological failures, political failures, human failures. And even if we get through all that, if we don't have a war because of the machine, if we build it correctly and without blowing ourselves up, I'm still worried."
"About what? How do you mean?" "The best that can happen is we will be made fools of."
"Who will?" "Arroway, don't you understand?"
A vein in Lunacharsky's neck throbbed.
"I'm amazed you don't see it. The Earth is a ghetto. Yes, a ghetto. All human beings are trapped here. We have heard vaguely that there are big cities out there beyond the ghetto, with broad boulevards filled with droshkies and beautiful perfumed women in furs. But the cities are too far away, and we are too poor ever to go there, even the richest of us. Anyway, we know they don't want us. That's why they've left us in this pathetic little village in the first place. And now along comes an invitation. As she said, fancy. Elegant. They have sent us an engraved card and an empty droshky. We are to send 5 villagers and the droshky will carry them to, who knows, Warsaw or Moscow? Maybe even Paris? Of course, some are tempted to go. There will always be people who are flattered by the invitation or who think it is a way to escape our shabby village. And what do you think will happen when we get there? Do you think the Grand Duke will have us to dinner? Will the president of the academy ask us interesting questions about daily life in our filthy shtetl? Do you imagine the Russian Orthodox metropolitan will engage us in learned discourse on comparative religion? No, Arroway. We will gawk at the big city, and they will laugh at us behind their hands. They will exhibit us to the curious. The more backward we are, the better they'll feel, the more reassured they'll be. It's a quota system. Every few centuries, 5 of us get to spend a weekend on Vega. Have pity on the provincials. And make sure they know who their betters are.
Chapter 13. Babylon. With the basest of companions, I walked the streets of Babylon. Augustine. Confessions 2-3. The Cray-21 mainframe computer at Argus had been instructed to compare each day's harvest of data from Vega with the earliest records of Level 3 of the palimpsest. In effect, one long and incomprehensible sequence of zeros and ones was being compared automatically with another, earlier such sequence. This was part of a massive statistical intercomparison of various segments of the still undecrypted text. There were some short sequences of zeros and ones, words, the analysts called them hopefully, which were repeated again and again. Many sequences would appear only once in thousands of pages of text. This statistical approach to message decryption was familiar to Ellie since high school. But the subroutines, supplied by the experts from the National Security Agency, made available only as a result of a presidential directive, and even then armed with instructions to self-destruct if examined closely, were brilliant. What prodigies of human inventiveness, Ellie reflected, were being directed to reading each other's mail. The global confrontation between the United States and the Soviet Union, now, to be sure, easing somewhat, was still eating up the world. It was not just the financial resources dedicated to the military establishments of all nations. That was approaching $2 trillion a year. And by itself was ruinously expensive when there were so many other urgent human needs. But still worse, she knew, was the intellectual effort dedicated to the arms race. Almost half the scientists on the planet, it had been estimated, were employed by one or another of the almost 200 military establishments worldwide. And they were not the dregs of the doctoral programs in physics and mathematics. Some of her colleagues would console themselves with this thought when the awkward problem arose of what to tell a recent doctoral candidate being courted by, say, one of the weapons laboratories.
If he was any good, he'd be offered an assistant professorship at Stanford, at least, she could recall Drumlin once saying.
Nope. A certain kind of mind and character was drawn to the military applications of science and mathematics. People who liked big explosions, for example. Or those with no taste for personal combat, who, to avenge some schoolyard injustice, aspired to military command. Or inveterate puzzle solvers, who longed to decrypt the most complex messages known. Occasionally the spur was political, tracing back to international disputes, immigration policies, wartime horrors, police brutality, or national propaganda by this nation or that decades earlier. Many of these scientists had real ability, Ellie knew, whatever reservations she might have about their motivations. She tried to imagine that massed talent really dedicated to the well-being of the species and the planet. She pored over the studies that had accumulated during her absence. They were making almost no progress in decrypting the message, although the statistical analyses now stacked into a pile of paper a meter tall. It was all very discouraging. She wished there were someone, especially a close woman friend at Argus, to whom she could pour out her hurt and anger at Ken's behavior. But there was not, and she was disinclined even to use the telephone for this purpose. She did manage to spend a weekend with her college friend, Becky Ellenbogen, in Austin. But Becky, whose appraisals of men tended to be somewhere between wry and scathing, in this case was surprisingly mild in her criticism.
He is the president's science advisor, and this is only the most amazing discovery in the history of the world. Don't be so hard on him, Becky urged. He'll come around.
But Becky was another of those who found Ken charming. She had met him once at the dedication of the National Neutrino Observatory, and was perhaps too inclined to accommodate to power. Had Drahir treated Ellie in this shabby way while he was a mere professor of molecular biology somewhere, Becky would have marinated and skewered the man. After returning from Paris, Drahir had mustered a regular campaign of apology and devotion. He had been overstressed, he told her, overwhelmed with a range of responsibilities, including difficult and unfamiliar political issues. His position as leader of the American delegation and co-chairman of the plenary might have been rendered less effective if there had been public knowledge of his and Ellie's relationship. Kit's had been insufferable. Ken had had too many consecutive nights with only a few hours' sleep. Altogether, Ellie judged, there were too many explanations, but she permitted the relationship to continue. When it happened, it was Willie once again, this time on the graveyard shift, who first noticed. Afterward, Willie would attribute the speed of the discovery less to the superconducting computer and the NSA programs than to the new Haddon context recognition chips. At any rate, Vega had been low in the sky an hour or so before dawn when the computer triggered an understated alarm. With some annoyance, Willie put down what he was reading. It was a new textbook on fast Fourier transform spectroscopy, and noticed these words being printed out on the screen. Repeat text pages 41,617 to 41,619. Bit mismatch. 0/2271. Correlation coefficient 0.99+. As he watched, 41,619 became 41,620 and then 41,621. The digits after the slash were increasing in a continuous blur. Both the number of pages and the correlation coefficient, a measure of the improbability that the correlation was by chance, increased as he watched. He gave it another 2 pages before picking up the direct line to Ellie's apartment. End of side 10. Side 11. She had been in a deep sleep and was momentarily disoriented, but she quickly turned on the bedside light and after a moment gave instructions for senior Argus staff to be assembled. She would, she told him, locate Jahir, who was somewhere on the facility. This proved not very difficult. She shook his shoulder. Ken, get up. There's word that we've repeated.
What?
The message has cycled back. Or at least, that's what Willie says. I'm on my way there. Why don't you wait another 10 minutes so we can pretend you were in your room in BSQ? She was almost at the door before he shouted after her.
How can we recycle? We haven't gotten the primer yet.
Racing across the screens was a paired sequence of zeros and ones, a real-time comparison of the data just being received and the data from an early page of text received at Argus a year before. The program would have culled out any differences. So far, there were none. It reassured them that they had not mistranscribed, that there were no apparent transmission errors, and that if some small, dense interstellar cloud between Vega and the Earth was able to eat the occasional zero or one, this was an infrequent occurrence. Argus was by now in real-time communication with dozens of other telescopes that were part of the World Message Consortium, and the news of recycling was passed on to the next observing stations westward, to California, Hawaii, the Marshall Nettelin now in the South Pacific, and to Sydney. Had the discovery been made when Vega was over one of the other telescopes in the network, Argus would have been informed instantly. The absence of the primer was an agonizing disappointment, but it was not the only surprise. The message page numbers had jumped discontinuously from the 40,000s to the 10,000s, where recycling had been uncovered. Evidently, Argus had discovered the transmission from Vega almost at the moment it first arrived at Earth. It was a remarkably strong signal and would have been picked up even by small, omnidirectional telescopes. But it was a surprising coincidence that the broadcast should arrive at Earth at the very moment Argus was looking at Vega. Also, what did it mean for the text to begin on a page in the 10,000s? Were there 10,000 pages of text missing? Was it a backward practice of the provincial Earth to start numbering books on page 1? Were these sequential numbers perhaps not page numbers, but something else? Or, and this worried Ellie the most,
Was there some fundamental and unexpected difference between how humans thought of things and how the aliens thought? If so, it would have worrisome implications about the ability of the consortium to understand the message, primer or no primer. The message repeated exactly. The gaps were all filled in and nobody could read a word of it. It seemed unlikely that the transmitting civilization, meticulous in all else, had simply overlooked the need for a primer. At least the Olympic broadcast and the interior design of the machine seemed to be tailored specifically for humans. They would hardly go to all this trouble to devise and transmit the message without making some provision for humans to read it. So humans must have overlooked something. It soon became generally agreed that somewhere was a fourth layer to the palimpsest. But where? The diagrams were published in an 8-volume coffee table book set that was soon reprinted worldwide. All over the planet, people tried to figure out the pictures. The dodecahedron and the quasi-biological forms were especially evocative. Many clever suggestions were made by the public and carefully sifted by the Argus team. Many harebrained interpretations were also widely available, especially in weekly newspapers. Whole new industries developed, doubtless unforeseen by those who devised the message, dedicated to using the diagrams to bilk the public. The ancient and mystical order of the dodecahedron was announced. The machine was a UFO. The machine was Ezekiel's wheel. An angel revealed the meaning of the message in the diagrams to a Brazilian businessman who distributed, at first at his own expense, his interpretation worldwide. With so many enigmatic diagrams to interpret, it was inevitable that many religions would recognize some of their iconography in the message from the stars. A principal cross-section of the machine looked something like a chrysanthemum, a fact that stirred great enthusiasm in Japan. If there had been an image of a human face among all the diagrams, messianic fervor might have reached a flashpoint. As it was, a surprisingly large number of people were winding up their affairs in preparation for the advent. Industrial productivity was off worldwide. Many had given away all their possessions to the poor, and then, as the end of the world was delayed, were obliged to seek help from a charity or the state. Because gifts of this sort constituted a major fraction of the resources of such charities, some of the philanthropists ended up being supported by their own gifts. Delegations approached government leaders to urge that schistomiasis, say, or world hunger be ended by the advent. Otherwise, there was no telling what would happen to us. Others counseled more quietly that if there was a decade of real world madness in the offing, there must be a considerable monetary or national advantage in it somewhere. Some said that there was no primer, that the whole exercise was to teach humans humility or to drive us mad. There were newspaper editorials on how we're not as smart as we think we are, and some resentment directed at the scientists, who, after all the support given to them by the governments, have failed us in our time of need. Or maybe humans are much dumber than the Vegans gave us credit for. Maybe there was some point that had been entirely obvious to all previous emerging civilizations so contacted, something no one in the history of the galaxy had ever missed before. A few commentators embraced this prospect of cosmic humiliation with real enthusiasm. It demonstrated what they'd been saying about people all along. After a while, Ellie decided that she needed help. They entered surreptitiously through the Enlil gate, with an escort dispatched by the proprietor. The General Services Administration security detail was edgy, despite or perhaps because of the additional protection. Although there was a little sunlight still left, the dirt streets were lit by braziers, oil lamps, and an occasional guttering torch. Two amphoras, each large enough to contain an adult human being, flanked the entrance to a retail olive oil establishment. The advertising was in cuneiform. On an adjacent public building was a magnificent bas-relief of a lion hunt from the reign of Assurbanipal. As they approached the Temple of Assur, there was a scuffle in the crowd, and her escort made a wide berth. She now had an unobstructed view of the ziggurat down a wide, torch-lit avenue. It was more breathtaking than in the pictures. There was a martial flourish on an unfamiliar brass instrument. Three men and a horse clattered by, the charioteer in Phrygian headdress. As in some medieval rendition of a cautionary tale from the Book of Genesis, the top of the ziggurat was enveloped in low, twilight clouds. They left the Ishtarian Way and entered the ziggurat through a side street. In the private elevator, her escort pressed the button for the topmost floor. 40, it read. No numerals, just the word. And then, to leave no room for doubt, a glass panel flashed, "The Gods." Mr. Haddon would be with her shortly. Would she like something to drink while she waited? Considering the reputation of the place, Ellie demurred. Babylon lay spread out before her, magnificent, as everyone said, in its recreation of a long-gone time and place. During daylight hours, busloads from museums, a very few schools, and the tourist agencies would arrive at the Ishtar Gate, don appropriate clothes, and travel back in time. Haddon wisely donated all profits from his daytime clientele to New York City and Long Island charities. The daytime tours were immensely popular, in part because it was a respectable opportunity to look the place over for those who would not dream of visiting Babylon at night. Well, maybe they would dream. After dark, Babylon was called an adult amusement park. It was of an opulence, scale, and imaginativeness that dwarfed, say, the Reeperbahn in Hamburg. It was by far the largest tourist attraction in the New York metropolitan area, with by far the largest gross revenues. How Haddon had been able to convince the city fathers of Babylon, New York, and how he had lobbied for an easement of local and state prostitution laws was well known. It was now a half-hour train ride from Midtown Manhattan to the Ishtar Gate. Ellie had insisted on taking this train, despite the entreaties of the security people, and had found almost a third of the visitors to be women. There were no graffiti, little danger of mugging, but a much inferior brand of white noise compared with the conveyances of the New York City subway system. Although Haddon was a member of the National Academy of Engineering, he had never, so far as Ellie knew, attended a meeting, and she had never set eyes on him. His face became well known to millions of Americans, however, years before, as a result of the Advertising Council's campaign against him. "The Un-American" had been the caption under an unflattering portrait of Haddon. Even so, she was taken aback when, in the midst of her reverie by the slanted glass wall, she was interrupted by a small, fat, beckoning person. "Oh, sorry. I never understand how anyone can be afraid of me." His voice was surprisingly musical. In fact, he seemed to talk in fifths. He hadn't thought it necessary to introduce himself, and once again inclined his head to the door he had left ajar. It was hard to believe that some crime of passion was about to be visited upon her under these circumstances, and wordlessly, she entered the next room. He ushered her to a meticulously crafted tabletop model of an ancient city of less pretentious aspect than Babylon. "Pompeii," he said by way of explanation. "The stadium here is the key. With the restrictions on boxing, there aren't any healthy blood sports left in America. Very important. Sucks out some of the poisons from the national bloodstream. The whole thing is designed, permits issued, and now this." "What's this?" "No gladiatorial games. I just got word from Sacramento. There's a bill before the legislature to outlaw gladiatorial games in California. Too violent, they say. They authorize a new skyscraper. They know they'll lose two or three construction workers. The unions know. The builders know. And that's just to build offices for oil companies or Beverly Hills lawyers. Oh, sure, we'd lose a few. But we're geared more to trident and net than the short sword. Those legislators don't have their priorities straight." He beamed at her owlishly and offered a drink, which again she refused. "So you want to talk to me about the machine. And I want to talk to you about the machine. You first. You want to know where the primer is? We're asking for help from a few key people who might have some insight. We thought with your record of invention, and since your context recognition chip was involved in the recycling discovery, that you might put yourself in the place of the Vegans and think of where you'd put the primer. We recognize you're very busy, and I'm sorry to... Oh, no, it's all right. It's true, I'm busy. I'm trying to regularize my affairs, because I'm going to make a big change in my life. For the millennium? She tried to imagine him giving away S.R. Haddon and Company, the Wall Street brokerage house, Genetic Engineering Incorporated, Haddon Cybernetics, and Babylon to the poor. Not exactly. No. It was fun to think about. It made me feel good to be asked. I looked at the diagrams. He waved at the commercial set of 8 volumes spread in disarray on a work table. There are wonderful things in there, but I don't think that's where the primer is hiding. Not in the diagrams. I don't know why you think the primer has to be in the message. Maybe they left it on Mars or Pluto or in the Oort comet cloud, and we'll discover it in a few centuries. Right now, we know there's this wonderful machine with design drawings and 30,000 pages of explanatory text. But we don't know whether we'd be able to build the thing if we could read it. So we wait a few centuries, improving our technology, knowing that sooner or later we'll have to be ready to build it. Not having the primer binds us up with future generations. Human beings are sent a problem that takes generations to solve. I don't think that's such a bad thing. Might be very healthy. Maybe you're making a mistake looking for a primer. Maybe it's better not to find it. No, I want to find the primer right away. We don't know it'll be waiting for us forever. If they hang up because there was no answer, it would be much worse than if they'd never called at all. Well, maybe you have a point. Anyway, I thought of as many possibilities as I could. I'll give you a couple of trivial possibilities and then a non-trivial possibility. Trivial first. The primer's in the message, but at a very different data rate. Suppose there was another message in there, at a bit an hour. Could you detect that? Absolutely. We routinely check for long-term receiver drift in any case, but also a bit an hour only buys you, let me see, 10,000-20,000 bits tops before the message recycles. So that makes sense only if the primer is much easier than the message. You think it isn't. I think it isn't. Now, what about much faster bit rates? How do you know that under every bit of your machine message, there aren't a million bits of primer message? Because it would produce monster bandwidths. We'd know in an instant. Okay, so there's a fast data dump every now and then. Think of it as microfilm. There's a tiny dot of microfilm that's sitting in repetitive parts of the message. I'm imagining a little box that says in your regular language, I am the primer. Then right after that, there's a dot. And in that dot is 100 million bits, very fast. You might see if you've got any boxes. Believe me, we would have seen it. Okay, how about phase modulation? We use it in radar and spacecraft telemetry, and it hardly messes up the spectrum at all. Have you hooked up a phase correlator? No, that's a useful idea. I'll look into it. Now, the non-trivial idea is this. If the machine ever gets made, if our people are going to sit in it, somebody's going to press a button, and then those 5 are going to go somewhere. Never mind where. Now, there's an interesting question whether those 5 are going to come back. Maybe not. I like the idea that all this machine design was invented by Vegan body snatchers. You know, they're medical students or anthropologists or something. They need a few human bodies. Oh, it's a big hassle to come to Earth. You need permission, passes from the transit authority. Oh, hell, it's more trouble than it's worth. But with a little effort, you can send the Earth a message. And then the Earthlings go to all the trouble to ship you 5 bodies. It's like stamp collecting. I used to collect stamps when I was a kid. You could send a letter to somebody in a foreign country, and most of the time they'd write back. It didn't matter what they said. All you wanted was a stamp. So that's my picture. There's a few stamp collectors on Vega. They send letters out when they're in the mood, and bodies come flying back to them from all over space. Wouldn't you like to see the collection? He smiled up at her and continued, okay. So what does this have to do with finding the primer? Nothing. It's relevant only if I'm wrong. If my picture is wrong, if the five people are coming back to Earth, then it would be a big help if we've invented spaceflight. No matter how smart they are, it's going to be tough to land the machine. Too many things are moving. God knows what the propulsion system is. If you pop out of space a few meters below ground, you've had it. And what's a few meters in 26 light years? It's too risky. When the machine comes back, it'll pop out, or whatever it does, in space, somewhere near the Earth. But not on it, or in it. So they have to be sure we have spaceflight, so the five people can be rescued in space. They're in a hurry and can't sit tight until the 1957 evening news arrives on Vega. So what do? They arrange so part of the message can only be detected from space. What part is that? The primer. If you can detect the primer, you've got spaceflight, and you can come back safe. So I imagine the primer is being sent at the frequency of the oxygen absorptions in the microwave spectrum, or in the near-infrared. Some part of the spectrum you can't detect until you're well out of the Earth's atmosphere. We've had the Hubble telescope looking at Vega all through the ultraviolet, visible, and near-infrared. Not a hint of anything. The Russians have repaired their millimeter wave instrument. They've hardly been looking at anything besides Vega, and they haven't found anything. But we'll keep looking. Other possibilities? Sure you wouldn't like a drink? I don't drink myself, but so many people do. Ellie again declined. No other possibilities. And now it's my turn. You see, I want to ask you for something. But I'm not good at asking for things. I never have been. My public image is rich, funny-looking, unscrupulous. Somebody who looks for weaknesses in the system so he can make a fast buck. And don't tell me you don't believe any of that. Everybody believes at least some of it. You've probably heard some of what I'm going to say before, but give me 10 minutes and I'll tell you how all this began. I want you to know something about me. She settled back, wondering what he could possibly want of her, and brushed away idle fantasies involving the Temple of Ishtar, Hadden, and perhaps a charioteer or two thrown in for good measure. Years before, he had invented a module that, when a television commercial appeared, automatically muted the sound. It wasn't at first a context recognition device. Instead, it simply monitored the amplitude of the carrier wave. TV advertisers had taken to running their ads louder and with less audio clutter than the programs that were their nominal vehicles. News of Haddon's module spread by word of mouth. People reported a sense of relief, the lifting of a great burden, even a feeling of joy at being freed from the advertising barrage for the 6 to 8 hours out of every day that the average American spent in front of the television set. Before there could be any coordinated response from the television advertising industry, Adnix had become wildly popular. It forced advertisers and networks into new choices of carrier wave strategy, each of which had encountered with a new invention. Sometimes he invented circuits to defeat strategies that the agencies and the networks had not yet hit upon. He would say that he was saving them the trouble of making inventions, at great cost to their shareholders, which were at any rate doomed to failure. As his sales volume increased, he kept cutting prices. It was a kind of electronic warfare, and he was winning. They tried to sue him, something about a conspiracy and restraint of trade. They had sufficient political muscle that his motion for summary dismissal was denied, but insufficient influence to actually win the case. The trial had forced Haddon to investigate the relevant legal codes. Soon after, he applied through a well-known Madison Avenue agency in which he was now a major silent partner to advertise his own products on commercial television. After a few weeks of controversy, his commercials were refused. He sued all three networks and in this trial was able to prove conspiracy in restraint of trade. He received a huge settlement that was at the time a record for cases of this sort and which contributed in its modest way to the demise of the original networks. There had always been people who enjoyed the commercials, of course, and they had no need for Adnix. But they were a dwindling minority. Haddon made a great fortune by eviscerating broadcast advertising. He also made many enemies.
By the time context recognition chips were commercially available, he was ready with Preachnix, a sub-module which could be plugged into AdNix. It would simply switch channels if, by chance, a doctrinaire religious program should be tuned in. You could pre-select keywords such as Advent or Rapture and cut great swathes through the available programming. Preachnix was a godsend for a long-suffering but significant minority of television viewers. There was talk, some of it half-serious, that Haddon's next submodule would be called JiveNix and would work only on public addresses by presidents and premiers. As he further developed context recognition chips, it became obvious to him that they had much wider applications, from education, science, and medicine to military intelligence and industrial espionage. It was on this issue that the lines were drawn for the famous suit United States versus Haddon Cybernetics. One of Haddon's chips was considered too good for civilian life, and on recommendation of the National Security Agency, the facilities and key personnel for the most advanced context recognition chip production were taken over by the government. It was simply too important to read the Russian mail. God knows, they told him, what would happen if the Russians could read our mail. Haddon refused to cooperate in the takeover and vowed to diversify into areas that could not possibly be connected with national security. The government was nationalizing industry, he said. They claimed to be capitalists, but when push came to shove, they showed their socialist face. He had found an unsatisfied public need and employed an existing and legal new technology to deliver what they wanted. It was classic capitalism. But there were many sober capitalists who would tell you that he had already gone too far with AdNix, that he had posed a real threat to the American way of life. In a Dur column, signed V. Petrov, Pravda called it a concrete example of the contradictions of capitalism. The Wall Street Journal countered, perhaps a little tangentially, by calling Pravda, which in Russian means truth, a concrete example of the contradictions of communism. He suspected that the takeover was only a pretext, that his real offense had been to attack advertising and video evangelism. AdNix and Preachnix were the essence of capitalist entrepreneurship, he argued repeatedly. The point of capitalism was supposed to be providing people with alternatives. Well, the absence of advertising is an alternative, I told them. There are huge advertising budgets only when there's no difference between the products. If the products really were different, people would buy the one that's better. Advertising teaches people not to trust their judgment. Advertising teaches people to be stupid. A strong country needs smart people. So AdNix is patriotic. The manufacturers can use some of their advertising budgets to improve their products. The consumer will benefit. Magazines and newspapers and direct mail business will boom, and that'll ease the pain in the ad agencies. I don't see what the problem is. AdNix, much more than the innumerable libel suits against the original commercial networks, led directly to their demise. For a while, there was a small army of unemployed advertising executives, down-and-out former network officials, and penniless divines who had sworn blood oaths to revenge themselves on Haddon. And there was an ever-growing number of still more formidable adversaries. Without a doubt, she thought, Haddon was an interesting man. So I figure it's time to go. I've got more money than I know what to do with. My wife can't stand me. And I've got enemies everywhere. I want to do something important. Something worthy. I want to do something so that hundreds of years from now, people will look back and be glad I was around. You want to... I want to build a machine. Look, I'm perfectly suited for it. I've got the best cybernetics expertise, practical cybernetics in the business. Better than Carnegie Mellon, better than MIT, better than Stanford, better than Santa Barbara. And if there's anything clear from those plans, it's that this isn't a job for an old-time tool-and-die maker. And you're going to need something like genetic engineering. You won't find anybody more dedicated to this job. And I'll do it at cost. Really, Mr. Haddon,
Who builds the machine, if we ever get to that point, isn't up to me. It's an international decision. All sorts of politics is involved. They're still debating in Paris about whether to build the thing, if and when we decrypt the message. Don't you think I know that? I'm also applying through the usual channels of influence and corruption. I just want to have a good word put in for me for the right reasons, by the side of the angels. You understand? And speaking of angels, you really shook up Palmer Joss and Billy Joe Rankin. I haven't seen them so agitated since that trouble they had about Mary's Waters. Rankin saying he was deliberately misquoted about supporting the machine. My, my. He shook his head in mock consternation. That some long-standing personal enmity existed between these active proselytizers and the inventor of preachniks seemed probable enough. And for some reason she was moved to their defense. Well, they're both a lot smarter than you might think. And Palmer Joss is, well, there's something genuine about him. He's not a phony. You're sure it's not just another pretty face? Excuse me, but it's important that people understand their feelings on this. It's too important not to. I know these clowns. Underneath, when push comes to shove, they're jackals. A lot of people find religion attractive. You know, personally, sexually. You ought to see what happens in the Temple of Ishtar. She repressed a small shiver of revulsion. I think I will have that drink, she said. Looking down from the penthouse, she could see the gradated tiers of the ziggurat, each draped with flowers, some artificial, some real, depending on the season. It was a reconstruction of the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. Miraculously, it was so arranged that it did not closely resemble a Hyatt hotel. Far below, she could make out a torchlit procession headed back from the ziggurat to the Enlil Gate. It was led by a kind of sedan chair, held by four burly men stripped to the waist. Who or what was in it she could not make out. It's a ceremony in honor of Gilgamesh, one of the ancient Sumerian culture heroes. Yes, I've heard of him. Immortality was his business. He said this matter-of-factly, by way of explanation, and looked at his watch. It's at the very top of the ziggurat, you know, that the kings would go to receive instruction from the gods, especially from Anu, the sky god. By the way, I looked up what they called Vega. It was Tirana, the life of heaven. It's a funny thing to call it. And have you gotten any instructions? No, they went to your place, not mine. But there'll be another Gilgamesh procession at 9 o'clock. I'm afraid I won't be able to stay that long. But let me ask you something. Why Babylon? She asked. And Pompeii? Here you are, one of the most inventive people around. You've created several major industries. You defeated the advertising industry on its own ground. Okay, so you got whipped on that security issue on the context recognition chip. There's lots of other things you could have done. Why this? Far away, the procession had reached the Temple of Osir. Why not something more worthy? He asked. I'm just trying to satisfy societal needs that the government overlooks or ignores. It's capitalism. It's legal. It makes a lot of people happy. And I think it's a safety valve for some of the crazies that this society keeps generating. But I didn't think all that through at the time. It's very simple. I can remember exactly the moment when the idea for Babylon hit me. I was in Walt Disney World, riding the Mississippi Sternwheeler riverboat with my grandson Jason. Jason was around 4, maybe 5. I was thinking about how smart the Disney people were to discontinue individual tickets for each ride and instead offer a one-day pass which admitted you to everything. They saved some salaries, some of the ticket takers, for instance. But much more important, people tended to overestimate their appetites for rides. They'd pay a premium to be admitted to everything, and then they'd be happy with a lot less. Now, next to me and Jason was an 8-year-old boy with a faraway look in his eye. I'm guessing his age. Maybe he was 10. His father was asking him stuff, and he was answering in monosyllables. The boy was fondling the barrel of a toy rifle he'd propped up on his deck chair. The stock was between his legs. All he wanted was to be left alone and stroke the rifle. Behind him were the towers and spires of the Magic Kingdom, and suddenly everything fell into place. You know what I'm saying? He filled a tumbler with Diet Cola and clicked it against her glass. Confusion to your enemies, he toasted genially. I'll have them take you out by the Ishtar Gate. The procession's going to make things too crowded toward the Enlil Gate. Both escorts magically appeared, and it was evident she was being dismissed. She had little desire to linger. Oh, don't forget about the phase modulation and looking in the oxygen lines. But even if I'm wrong about where the primer is, don't forget. I'm the only one to build the machine. Floodlights brilliantly illuminated the Ishtar Gate. It was covered with representations in glazed tile of some blue animal. The archaeologists had called them dragons. Chapter 14. Harmonic Oscillator. Skepticism is the chastity of the intellect, and it is shameful to surrender it too soon or to the first comer. There is nobility in preserving it coolly and proudly through long youth, until at last, in the ripeness of instinct and discretion, it can be safely exchanged for fidelity and happiness. George Santayana, Skepticism and Animal Faith, 9. It was on a mission of insurgency and subversion. The enemy was vastly larger and more powerful, but it knew the enemy's weakness. It could take over the alien government, turning the resources of the adversary to its own purpose. Now, with millions of dedicated agents in place... She sneezed and tried to find a clean paper tissue in the bulging pocket of the terry cloth presidential bathrobe. She had no makeup on, although her chapped lips revealed patches of mentholated balm. My doctor tells me I have to stay in bed or I'll get viral pneumonia. I ask him for an antibiotic, and he tells me there's no antibiotic for viruses. So how does he know I have a virus? Dirheer opened his mouth to answer, a gesture in the making when the president cut him short. No, never mind. You'll start telling me about DNA and host recognition, and I'll need what resources I've got left to listen to your story. If you're not afraid of my virus, pull up a chair. Thank you, Miss President. This is about the primer. I have the report here. There's a long technical section that's included as an appendix. I thought you might be interested in it also. Briefly, we're reading and actually understanding the thing with almost no difficulty. It's a fiendishly clever learning program. I don't mean fiendishly in any literal sense, of course. We must have a vocabulary of 3,000 words by now. I don't understand how it's possible. I could see how they could teach you the names of their numbers. You make one dot and write the letters O-N-E underneath, and so on. I could see how you could have a picture of a star and then write S-T-A-R under it, but I don't see how you could do verbs or the past tense or conditionals. Well, they do some of it with movies. Movies are perfect for verbs. And a lot of it they do with numbers. Even abstractions. They can communicate abstractions with numbers. It goes something like this. First they count out the numbers for us, and then they introduce some new words. Words we don't understand. Here, I'll indicate their words by letters. We read something like this. The letters stand for symbols the Vegans introduce. He wrote, 1A1B2Z. 1A2B3Z. 1A7B8Z. What do you think it is? My high school report card. You mean there's a combination of dots and dashes that A stands for, and a different combination of dots and dashes that B stands for, and so on? Exactly. You know what 1 and 2 mean, but you don't know what A and B mean. What does a sequence like this tell you? A means plus and B means equals. Is that what you're getting at? Good. But we don't yet understand what Z means, right? Now along comes something like this. 1A2
B4Y. You see? Maybe. Give me another that ends in Y.
2000A, 4000B, 0Y.
Okay, I think I got it. As long as I don't read the last three symbols as a word, Z means it's true and Y means it's false. Right, exactly. Huh, pretty good for a president with a virus and a South African crisis. So with a few lines of text, they've taught us four words. Plus equals true, false. Four pretty useful words. Then they teach division. Divide one by zero and tell us the word for infinity. Or maybe it's just the word for indeterminate. Or they say the sum of the interior angles of a triangle is two right angles. Then they comment that the statement is true if space is flat, but false if space is curved. So you've learned how to say if, and I didn't know space was curved. Ken, what the hell are you talking about? How can space be curved? No, never mind, never mind. That can't have anything to do with the business in front of us. Well, actually, Saul Haddon tells me it was his idea where to find the primer. Don't look at me funny to hear. I talk to all types. I didn't mean, as I understand it, Mr. Haddon volunteered a few suggestions, which had all been made by other scientists as well. Dr. Arroway checked them out and hit pay dirt with one of them. It's called phase modulation, or phase coding. Yes. Now, is this correct, Ken? The primer is scattered throughout the message, right? Lots of repetitions. And there was some primer shortly after Arroway first picked up the signal. Shortly after she picked up the third layer of the palimpsest, the machine design. And many countries have the technology to read the primer, right? Well, they need a device called a phase correlator, but yes, the countries that count anyway. Then the Russians could have read the primer a year ago, right? Or the Chinese or the Japanese. How do you know they're not halfway to building the machine right now? I thought of that. But Marvin Yang says it's impossible. Satellite photography, electronic intelligence, people on the scene, all confirm that there's no sign of the kind of major construction project you'd need to build a machine. No. We've all been asleep at the switch. We were seduced by the idea that the primer had to come at the beginning and not interspersed through the message. It's only when the message recycled and we discovered it wasn't there that we started thinking of other possibilities. All this work has been done in close cooperation with the Russians and everybody else. We don't think anybody has the jump on us, but on the other hand, everybody has the primer now. I don't think there's any unilateral course of action for us. I don't want a unilateral course of action for us. I just want to make sure that nobody else has a unilateral course of action. Okay, so back to your primer. You know how to say true-false, if-then, and space is curved. How do you build a machine with that? You know, I don't think this cold or whatever you've got has slowed you down a bit. Well, it just takes off from there. For example, they draw us a periodic table of the elements. So they get to name all the chemical elements. The idea of an atom, the idea of a nucleus, protons, neutrons, electrons. Then they run through some quantum mechanics just to make sure we're paying attention. There are already some new insights for us in the remedial stuff. Then it starts concentrating on the particular materials needed for the construction. For example, for some reason we need 2 tons of erbium. So they run through a nifty technique to extract it from ordinary rocks. Derheer raised his hand palm outward in a placatory gesture. Don't ask why we need 2 tons of erbium. Nobody has the faintest idea. I wasn't going to ask that. I want to know how they told you how much a ton is. They counted it out for us in Planck masses. A Planck mass is... Never mind, never mind. It's something that physicists all over the universe know about, right? And I've never heard of it. Now, the bottom line. Do we understand the primer well enough to start reading the message? Will we be able to build the thing or not? The answer seems to be yes. We've only had the primer for a few weeks now, but whole chapters of the message are falling into our lap in clear. It's painstaking design, redundant explanations, and, as far as we can tell, tremendous redundancy in the machine design. We should have a three-dimensional model of the machine for you in time for that crew selection meeting on Thursday, if you feel up to it. So far,
We haven't a clue as to what the machine does or how it works. And there are some funny organic chemical components that don't make any sense as part of a machine. But almost everybody seems to think we can build the thing. Who doesn't? Well, Lunacharsky and the Russians. And Billy Joe Rankin, of course. There are still people who worry that the machine will blow up the world or tip the Earth's axis or something. But what's impressed most of the scientists is how careful the instructions are, and how many different ways they go about trying to explain the same thing. And what does Eleanor Arroway say? She says if they want to do us in, they'll be here in 25 years or so, and there's nothing we could do in 25 years to protect ourselves. They're too far ahead of us. So she says, build it, and if you're worried about environmental hazards, build it in a remote place. Professor Drumlin says you can build it in downtown Pasadena for all he cares. In fact, he says he'll be there every minute it takes to construct the machine, so he'll be the first to go if it blows up. Drumlin. He's the fellow who figured out that this was the design for a machine, right? Not exactly. I'll read all the briefing material in time for that Thursday meeting. You got anything else for me? Are you seriously considering letting Haddon build the machine? Well, it's not only up to me, as you know. That treaty they're hammering out in Paris gives us about a one-quarter say. The Russians have a quarter. The Chinese and the Japanese together have a quarter. And the rest of the world has a quarter, roughly speaking. A lot of nations want to build the machine, or at least parts of it. They're thinking about prestige and new industries, new knowledge. As long as no one gets a jump on us, that all sounds fine to me. It's possible Haddon might have a piece of it. What's the problem? Don't you think he's technically competent? Well, he certainly is. It's just... If there's nothing more, Ken, I'll see you Thursday. Virus Willie. Asdrahir was shutting the door and entering the adjacent sitting room. There was an explosive presidential sneeze. The warrant officer of the day, sitting stiffly on a couch, was visibly startled. The briefcase at his feet was crammed with authorization codes for nuclear war. Drahir calmed him with a repetitive gesture of his hand. Fingers spread, palm down. The officer gave an apologetic smile.
End of side 11.